Yoga Vashishta, Part 8 by Swami Suryadevananda. Prayer before study. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness, which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. Let us briefly review what we covered the last time. Restlessness is ignorance. Restlessness of the mind is mental conditioning or ignorance in operation. When the mind is observed without remission, mental conditioning and restlessness are significantly weakened. Then, meditation or inquiry destroys conditioning and restlessness to the root. The second point was controlling the mind. The mind must be trained to contemplate the truth in all things for it to realize the truth. Realization of the truth is when the truth becomes real to you by a direct experience. Mind alone is capable of controlling the mind. The third point was understanding renunciation. Desire or craving is ignorance, and its cessation is liberation. This is attained by being vigilant without remission and renunciation, and this takes inner strength. Then we had a closer look at renunciation. You cannot face the light if you do not turn your back to the darkness. Abandon the pursuit of pleasure. Remember the focus on the word pursuit. Give up all ideas of other. Go beyond even being and non-being and establish in the non-movement of consciousness. Our topics today include how bondage happens, mind is the doer, liberation and delusion, and the unconditioned state. The third and fourth topics are very close in their focus, and so there will be a little bit of repetition and redundancy on them, but it needs to be broken apart so we can have a closer look at them. Greetings. We start on the first topic for today, which is how bondage happens. Let's have a look at thought, the rising of thought. Thought arises on its mind on its own accord. When consciousness is aware of these thoughts arising, it's known as a mind. Our consciousness or awareness faces these thoughts and forgets its own source. And the first part, when it faces these thoughts and is aware of them, it is known as the mind. The substratum and essential substance of all that appears in consciousness is consciousness only. Whether it's thought or whatever, what is the substance of thought? It arises in consciousness, therefore it must be consciousness as its very base itself. Since consciousness is the all in all, which is omnipresent and omnipotent, the activity of throwing up thoughts expands very quickly and instantly. So it throws up thoughts, and the more we are aware of these thoughts that it throws up, the faster it throws up the thoughts. When we pay attention to them, forgetting our own nature, we get mixed up with them, and that is what happens. Consciousness is always self-aware And so it does not matter at its base level if these thoughts or notions rise. However, the problem happens when we get riveted to these appearances that appear in consciousness, and we find ourselves forgetting our true nature as pure consciousness. That is when the fall happens. Then there is a further fall, a second fall, when we find ourselves conceptualizing ourselves. See, concepts arise in consciousness, and we're aware of them. But when we become aware of them exclusively at the cost of ourselves or self-awareness, there is a problem. These thoughts start multiplying and increasing very, very rapidly. When our attention is disengaged from the inner sense of self, we forget our true nature, we lose awareness or self-awareness, and it's completely outward. Our attention is completely outward. Awareness is lost and bondage happens. So this is a step-by-step fall of how bondage happens. We cannot prevent the rising of thoughts. They arise and there is no harm at that portion at all. We are aware of these thoughts because they arise in the awareness or in consciousness. But when we become aware of them exclusively, we forget our self-nature. We become sort of fixed on them or fixated on them or obsessed on them, and then we start reacting to them. So they start multiplying. We lose our sense of self by losing our self-awareness. And what we have is thought reacting to thought and the increase of thought rapidly. So this is how bondage happens. The mind is completely bound by its identification with what it contemplates. It identifies with what it contemplates, and bondage happens. And how is it freed? It is freed by return to its original nature. The problem is, the firm conviction that I am different from the body and I am the supreme being destroys the ignorance and one is freed. The firm conviction that I am Mr. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so and these conditions and that in which I find myself as who I am and how I am is bondage. So let us see how we can go a little bit beyond this by getting a little bit more in detail. We've talked a little bit about how bondage happens. Now let us focus on the mind and action. The mind alone is the doer in all things. Whatever the mind contemplates, that the senses pursue, and then action follows suit. But it all starts with the mind, whatever it contemplates. This is why, my friends, one has to be very careful about the pursuit of pleasure. There is nothing wrong with the pleasures that come naturally. But this word pursuit is the problem, as the mind will pursue them regularly. What is pursuit? Going after something. And why? Because the mind feels sees value in it. And why? Because the mind feels a little bit less complete and feels a sense of completeness that may come from that object. There is a difference in what comes naturally and the pursuit of something. This pursuit is itself restlessness. And when we feel that that object is the object of pleasure, the senses are going to want to pursue it relentlessly. This pursuit itself leads to the absence or fall or loss of peace. The mind registers the form within itself and then pursues that form within itself, all within itself. Now we may think and we may feel that we are pursuing what is outside, but actually this chase goes on inside because the mind is pursuing its notion of that object and what it feels that object will bring. If it doesn't feel that that object will bring anything, add to its completeness, fullness, or give it something, it's not going to pursue it. So ultimately, this chase happens within the mind, and pursuit is restlessness, and the mind keeps up this game within it. To learn to live and to enjoy things that come naturally as they come, and separate action from that enjoyment is a very good thing. We may feel that the pursuit of something, we are in pursuit of something outside, my friends, but this is all imagination. It all happens inside. There is inner fragmentation. One part of the mind is pursuing another part of the mind within it. The object or what it wants is within it, the idea or notion of that object. It's not actually pursuing the object, it's pursuing the notion of that object. What it thinks that object will bring. It will bring peace, it will bring this. This person means that to me, or this thing means that to me, or that condition means that to me. If this arrangement was not there inside, there would be no pursuit. Now, just who makes that value? The mind itself assigns that value. The mind itself pushes towards pursuit. What we do externally is just trying to fulfill that urge of what rises within us. It's a real jugglery, my friends, of the mind within itself. So what do we do about it, and what is our solution? First of all, we need to separate action from all these ideas of joy. That will bring joy, this will bring joy, this will deliver, etc. down the line. Do what needs to be done, do it wholeheartedly, but do it as duty. Why? On its own merit. Why can't action stand on its own merit? Why does it always have to have a carrot attached to it? We're intelligent enough to look and see what needs to be done, and do it wholeheartedly with all our mind, and find our sense of satisfaction from doing what needed to be done wholeheartedly. Take everything else completely out of the equation. And what does this do? Along, when you take things out of the equation, the I, me, and mine, it keeps the twin currents of like and dislike, which are called raga and dvesha in Sanskrit, or infatuation and aversion, it keeps them out of the equation completely, and therefore out of consciousness. When like and dislike are taken out of consciousness, a whole lot of our sorrow and turmoil, or just about all of it, is taken out of it. When our sorrow and turmoil is taken out of consciousness, the natural joy of oneself rises to the surface. The mind stays whole, it stays full and undivided. And this sense of fullness is joy that is experienced naturally. It is the natural joy of oneself that just bubbles to the surface and one delights in it. See, the whole thing about this comes from that and that comes from this is a jugglery of the mind that has to be abandoned. The happiness that is felt by this fragmentation is an apparent recovery, so to say, of fragmentation first and then a coming together for a brief moment so that fullness is experienced. Why can't we experience that fullness in itself naturally as it is without this jugglery at all? Because that jugglery is riddled with unhappiness. What if it doesn't come? All the turmoil that comes in between. So we create all this turmoil, experience it, and then look forward to that one moment of coming together. But the mind is together to begin with. Why do we have to go through all this jugglery to experience the fullness of the self? So therefore, Vashishtha tells us that the mind alone is the doer in all things. Because it is the mind that pursues, the mind that assigns the value, the mind that pursues everything, not the body. The body is only the instrument. And therefore, the mind alone experiences the fruits of action and not the body. We may think that this has come upon us and I'm having a hard time externally or whatever, but the mind alone is the doer and the experiencer. The objects that are pursued are forms taken in and by the pursuer in the confusion of experience. If we did not have these values assigned to them, we wouldn't pursue them. See, my friends, finally, we never pursue anybody, anything, or any condition. We pursue the values that we have attached to them, and those values are in our mind. So the mind pursues the mind, and the objects are an excuse for this ignorance. You have to see through this and not cooperate with this whole game. Now, for that, we come to that very first principle that we spoke about, which is doing what needs to be done because it needs to be done wholeheartedly with all of our mind and soul, because it needs to be done on its own merit. Completely take out reward and what's in it for me out of this, and you will completely shake up that mind from its involvement in action. Let this inner awareness of consciousness that is also aware of the mind directly engage each situation to see what needs to be done and do what needs to be done without thickening or fattening the sense of I, me, and mine. And what will happen is we will respond to everything just like a crystal reflects the objects non-volitionally, without the I, me, and mine. And then we would stand with things rather than stand outside of things, and there would be a natural sense of fullness that we would experience with this. My friends, this brings us to the second half. And I mentioned earlier when we began that the last two topics are very, very closely related, so there will be some overlap. Let us talk a little bit about liberation and delusion. Vasishtha says, being established in one's true nature, attained by direct experience, is liberation. And about delusion, losing sight of one's true nature by awareness of the other, when we create the other and the other is real to us, that is delusion. We find a very similar thing in another scripture called the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where the great sage says that otherness itself is the problem. And he says, dvitiyam bhayam bhavati. Whenever there is other, there is fear, there is delusion, there is a problem. So what do we do and how do we handle this otherness? That is the problem. Friends, let us slow down a little bit and take a closer look at how we can establish our sense of self in our true nature. First of all, the self can only be experienced by the self. So there are about three things that come to mind that we should focus on. First of all, we should keep any redundant sense of self or ego out of perception. And to start with, we have to keep it out of action and fruition. When we focus on each situation to see what needs to be done, and don't allow the ego or personality to interfere, in other words, what needs to be done gets mixed up with what's in it for me. Why does the me have to get mixed up with a situation? My friends, this is just a habit. And this is at the root of a lot of our problems, confusion, stress, and all of that. Can we look at every situation and see it for what it is and bring that clarity in that mind? That clarity, my friends, is itself peace, is itself the seeds of happiness, joy, and the unfoldment of our true nature. You will see that when you start working with this little by little. So can we keep action and fruition? What's in it for me what I should do, can we keep the I out of it and stand with the situation? When you look at what needs to be done, you stand as part of the situation and there is expansion. Once we bring in the I, me, mine into it, there is contraction, we stand out of the situation and there is a smallness felt in our personality. We may think we take care of our interests, but my friends, we really don't. When we stand outside things and we become smaller, we don't take care of our interests. There is a contraction and there is a loss, and we don't realize this. So where do we start? The very first thing is really wanting to break free from the ego. You cannot break free from this ego unless you have seen its destructiveness. And you clearly want to break free and clear of the ego. It is then that ongoing vigilance comes into force. This natural vigilance, it sees the danger of the ego and the havoc the ego plays. And it naturally starts watching it along with watching every situation. This watching itself keeps the ego out of the mischief of involvement with the situation. But this watching has to be non-selective and fully empowered. These are the two conditions. See, my friends, we all like to say, yes, I see the harm of the ego and I want to activate this. But I'd like to do it in these situations, but with my people or these or my family or my friend with that, let me relax this and whatever goes. See, my friends, it cannot work. It's an all or nothing principle. And this does not make you impersonal or a block of stone or anything of that kind at all. That's all delusion. To be able to watch and see what needs to be done has to happen in all conditions, all the time, non-selectively. And this non-selectiveness is full empowerment. And that is the ticket. That is what needs to happen. So for this, a life of discipline, which enables one to do one thing at one time while disengaging from all the non-essential or counterproductive mental and physical activity is needed. To be able to see what needs to be done, we need to slow down and do one thing at one time. When we try to do multiple things at one time, my friend, there is no inner clarity. Purposes overlap. The ego is not seen. Everything is mixed up and in the shades of gray. And we're sort of just getting by with volume activity with a total loss of self-awareness or sense of purpose. Life seems to be a grind at that time, but it doesn't need to be so. Now let us cover, you've just talked about keeping the redundant sense or ego out of action and fruition. That is the very first thing. The second thing, all inner activity has to be brought in the same field of awareness as what we call outer activity and kept there. We have to come to this state, and the simple practices like japa and meditation, we are doing what needs to be done, keeping our focus on one thing. Let me take up the example of japa, a very simple thing. Whether you do it with the mala or the japa beads or rosary or without that. And I've covered that in another video that's on my website and YouTube. You simply roll the beads while you are repeating the name of the Lord. And while you are rolling the beads, you're also aware of the rise and fall of thoughts. But you learn how not to be mixed up in them by keeping your attention on the beads. So you learn how to do what needs to be done. Put your heart into it because you have love for God. His name and Him are one. When you are repeating it, you learn to put your attention on what you are doing while you have awareness of thoughts, letting them rise, letting them fall without losing your focus on what you are doing. This practice has tremendous benefit in separating consciousness and the conditioned mind. So when we do these basic practices and the practice of meditation, you learn how to bring all the inner thought world into the same field of view as the outer, because the outer and the inner are perceived in or experienced or known in the same awareness. And we spoke about this the last time. So this, my friends, is the full empowerment of vigilance which needs to happen to break delusion. Delusion is when vigilance is not there, when this awareness is not there. This vigilance does not involve any form of suppression at all. It purifies by the awareness, staying aware. Awareness stays aware so that it can be self-aware. When awareness stays aware, it expands. And when it expands to its climax, there is self-awareness. Instead of awareness of something, awareness at a time, awareness as someone, etc. down the line, there is just awareness, full awareness. Can we take the off and by completely out of the equation by awareness, being aware, so that it can reach the level of self-awareness? That is the second part of it. The third part of it is when all these gathered rays of the mind, all this awareness, is focused upon itself to be self-aware. Until we have this gathering of the rays of the mind, it is going to be impossible to put it upon itself. See, my friends, even to buy something, you need money, you need capital. You need to have saved up some money to buy something. Say you want to buy a house or a car. You need to save up some money, and with that money, you can buy something. So also with consciousness. For self-awareness, we have to first gather the rays of the mind. They're all scattered, and we spoke about how that happens, the discipline by which that happens. Then these gathered rays of the mind are to be focused upon themselves for self-awareness in meditation and self-inquiry. Now, my friends, I spoke earlier that there would be a little bit of redundancy in the second and third points because they were closely related. Actually, they were one, but we broke them apart so that we could have a closer look at it. This unconditioned state, there's not so much to be said in words. It is something that has to be experienced. But a few words are in order. The conditioned mind goes from one object or one condition or one situation to another, whereas the unconditioned intelligence is between this and that, and it is that which maintains continuity because it's always steady. Even though I'm aware of this situation and that situation and this condition, it's the same I behind everything that's aware of this or that's aware of that. I may go to work and be aware of work or the conditions at work, and I may come home and be aware of the conditions at home and say, well, here is the family man hat, there is the work person hat, etc. down the line. But beneath all those hats, it's the same person. It's the same awareness that also was there when I was a child. The same awareness, though the body has aged, is aware that this body has aged. That awareness has not aged. It's aware of age. It's aware of time. It's aware of changing conditions. So it must be the same. It must be unconditioned. The conditions have changed, but something is aware of those changing conditions. That something has not changed, and therefore it is unconditioned. The question before us is to return to this and establish our sense of self in that unconditioned state, in that unconditioned being. That is our true nature. To see your true nature, we have to do something, or return to it. Not because doing is needed, because the doing is an actual undoing of the errors that have been done, called conditioning. The undoing of conditioning, or the reversal of conditioning, is what the doing that is focused upon. Firstly, Three things. Live in such a way that reduces the unnecessary activity of the mind as much as possible. To see the havoc that the mind creates, we have to be able to observe this mind relentlessly. That which observes this mind is not the conditioning. That which observes the conditioned is the unconditioned state. That which observes the mischief is clarity. For that, there must be reduced activity. There's a lot of unnecessary activity in our life that we can get rid of and streamline and focus it so this can give rise to inner clarity. Without reduced activity of the mind, it'll be very difficult to observe the mind as we will constantly feel ourselves getting mixed up with rising thought. So reduce the activity and live in such a way, doing one thing at one time, so we can clearly see all the activity of the mind and the sense, also feel the sense of self, which is that which observes the activity of the mind. When we observe the activity of the mind, we're also observing the situation. In each situation, it's the same intelligence that's observing the mind that also sees what needs to be done. Let that respond to what needs to be done. Instead of this ego, the I, my, and mine reacting to the situation. Take the ego completely out of action. Out of the equation of action completely is the first process in dismantling the ego. Can this ego be kept out of all action, whether it's action in the workplace, action at home, or whatever? Can action stand on its own merit? Why does action have to be driven by motive? Can I not do what needs to be done? Why do I have to do what's in it for me? Why does the me or the I have to get mixed up with every situation? As a matter of fact, like we've spoken earlier, when this mix-up happens, I do less. And I do it in a lesser manner, because I always think of what's in it for me. And I do it sort of in a choked-up manner. But when I do things because they need to be done, I can do everything wholeheartedly. And in that wholeheartedness, my friends, there is joy. Because whenever there is that word whole, there is fullness. And in fullness, there is joy, natural joy. The natural joy of the self bubbles up to the surface when we take out this reduction factor in it. And when the mind is kept full, the third point, it's possible to begin direct observation of the mind, which we just spoke about, or self-inquiry. See, my friends, as we spoke of earlier, even to buy a house or to buy a car or something nice, you need capital. So save this capital of your own self by avoiding the fragmentation or reduction to begin with, by living intelligently. And with that capital or that sense of fullness, let that sense of fullness of self focus upon its source in self-inquiry. That state in which there is an absence of all concepts, and when the consciousness remains motionless, neither a sense of dullness nor inertia, that is the unconditioned state. But we come to that in stages, which we have spoke about, where all these notions of I and division, of me and mine, are first taken out of the equation. Later, these will all cease to be, and the fullness of ourself will inquire into the fullness of its true nature, and it will know the fullness of its own true nature. But it all starts in a very practical way with small steps. Friends, we spoke about four things today that are quite closely related. Now again, as we talk, there might be a little bit of redundancy felt, both in the same talk or discussion and in earlier discussions. But this is important, I feel, because we get a chance to focus on things a little bit closer and bring them to heart so we can test these or try these out wholeheartedly for ourselves. We spoke about four things today. How bondage happens. Concepts arise naturally in consciousness on their own accord. Notions, concepts, ideas, feelings, these arise naturally. Getting mixed up with them is not natural. It is something that happens when we are not careful. When we become careless, the sense of I or self is lost and we get mixed up with them. It is this mix-up that is at the root of all of our sufferings and turmoil. And it is this mix-up that must be removed. Consciousness is aware of these concepts. When it is aware of these concepts, that is known as the mind. But when these concepts start conceptualizing by themselves, awareness is lost and bondage happens. So what is the solution for this? The solution we came up with is eternal vigilance without remission. Being able to see this is the empowering of the inner intelligence. The second point we talked about was that mind itself is the doer. Whatever the mind contemplates, that the senses pursue. The senses will not pursue that which the mind does not contemplate. So avoid the pursuit of pleasure with full resolve. Learn to associate joy with doing what needs to be done wholeheartedly every moment. Just doing it on its own merit and take the I, me and mine completely out of it. Therefore, bringing it down a little further, remain engaged in activity as duty, without any infatuation or aversion. You may feel that's dull, but when you take infatuation and aversion in it, you take likes and dislikes out of it. It is these two twin currents called raga dvesha, likes and dislikes, infatuation and aversion, that is at the seed or the root of all of our sorrow. So the solution for the second point is to learn and embrace all activity as duty and yoga. If we learn to live as yoga, and what is yoga? Not just a technique. Yoga is a coming together. So there is a discovery of the sense of fullness of who we are. There is not actually a coming together, but there is a sense of breaking away that is repaired or done away with. And we call that the coming together or the discovery or the fullness of being. The last two points, as we mentioned earlier, are quite close. Actually, they are one, sort of broken apart. But let us take a look at them apart as we discuss them. Liberation and delusion. Being established in one's true nature, attained by direct experience, is liberation. Losing sight of one's true nature by awareness of the other or the outer is delusion. And what is the solution for this? We spoke about three things. Keep any sense of redundant self or ego out of perception, action, and fruition, which is seeing, action, or doing, and fruition or enjoying. Can we keep the ego out of these three? Perception, action, and fruition. Let us just call this an acronym, PAF. Perception, action, fruition. This is the whole process of how the ego gets fatter. Can we keep it out of that? Both before, during, and after. Completely out of the process of engagement of life. Keep the ego out of life. When the mind's activity is able to be observed relentlessly, one can do what needs to be done. We have to bring this ego into the field of observation for this to happen. We have to be able to see it along with what's out there. The problem that happens is we are seeing what's out there always mixed up with our ego, and we are unable to see things with a level of clarity. We must be able to bring a level of clarity where we see what needs to be done along with all the promptings and grumblings and murmurings of the ego at the same time, and to do what needs to be done because it needs to be done wholeheartedly, and weaken the ego and thus dismantle it by disuse. It is only then, my friends, that we will be able to turn the rays of the mind, the gathered rays of the mind, upon its source in the hours of meditation. Lastly, we spoke about the unconditioned state. And again, there will be a little bit of redundancy, as I mentioned, but this is essential in having a closer look at it to add to the clarity of understanding. The conditioned mind goes from one object to the other, because the conditioned mind is based upon otherness. The unconditioned intelligence or mind is always between this and that and the other. And so it doesn't go from one to the other, because all the other rises and falls in it. It is aware of otherness, so it must be constant. To be able to rest in this, to be able to fix in this, by functioning in this, and therefore allowing this to look at its source. The conditioned mind cannot look at its source. It can only look at conditioning. The unconditioned mind alone can look at its source. For that, it must be empowered. And that is done by what we have spoken about in life. Unless we do this, we're not going to be able to inquire into ourselves in the hours of meditation and go beyond illusion. The choice is up to each one of us. Friends, we spoke of a good many things today. The next time, we continue with the important teachings in the third chapter. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download this video, its audio, or a PDF summary, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.